It's raining, of course. On an October afternoon in Lancashire, in the north of England, journalist Jim Watterson, founder of the independent online magazine London Centric, is standing in front of gates guarded by massive concrete snails, like stone dragons at the doors of a very slow pagoda. The journalist is fully expecting to be denied entry and, in the first of today's Britishisms, told to piss off. To his surprise, Watterson is welcomed inside the property. What he finds there is a story involving snails, Neapolitan mafia dons, beauty products, shoe trafficking, a Bentley, tax evasion schemes, Michael Gove, right-wing politician and helmsman of Brexit, a football club, a caravan, a beer called Shag. And through it all, it's raining snails. Hallelujah. In London office buildings, in Lancashire freezers, spreading their mucus on property tax law, snails partaking in orgies, cannibalizing their neighbors, eating themselves. That got dark fast, but that's snails for you. What do you think the horns stood for? While a previous episode of Tor's Cabinet took you to the darker recesses of tax fraud for the benefit of drug dealers and the CIA, we're looking at a lighter side here. For starters, at least. We're definitely not endorsing tax evasion, though, or the mob, or the political proclivities of our protagonist, or, for that matter, snails. This is the story of a reprehensible yet colorful British eccentric filling London one office building at a time with his hermaphrodite pulmonate gastropod mollusks. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Siegfried the Slug, and Thimble the Doll, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. This is my kind of episode.
This episode is about snails. You are a slug.
Yeah, but we gastropods stick together. We kinda don't have a choice. We're sticky.
Don't you have a sticker on your slug bug that says, "Snails will be salted on sight"?
Hey, that's just a friendly rivalry, like we're fans of different K-pop groups.
Ah yes, when this one thinks of a calm and non-toxic community, K-pop fandoms are exactly what springs to mind.
Anyway, Siegfried, what are you sitting on? It's a desk?
Snails are surprisingly dangerous. I was going to say, but not as dangerous as trains, but I'm actually not certain whether the number of people killed by snails in a year is smaller than the number killed by trains, because of a disease I've actually mentioned on Tor's Cabinet before, Bilharzia. In my episode about that bonkers African billboard, Bilharzia is a parasitic infection spread by snails. Statistics on global Bilharzia deaths vary a lot, such that I'm not sure what kills more people, snails or trains, but trains are dangerous, and no one knew that better than Alonzo Billups, who built the subject of another past Tor's Cabinet episode, the Billups Neon Crossing Signal. Here's a beautiful, haunting work of art inspired by the Billups Crossing, drawn by my in-house artist Captain Capslock, and are you looking to rent offices in the center of London? We have just what you need. 2,400 square feet of open space with hardwood floors and AC, a stone's throw from the Edgware Road tube station, and 10 minutes on foot from the National Rail Hub at Paddington, the heart of the city, complete with Peruvian bears and marmalade sandwiches. Naturally, for such a central location, the asking price is high, about $7,500 per month, plus taxes. Taxes, or rather the pathological avoidance thereof, is what brings Jim Watterson to Lancashire. He's no tax man. He's researching London's variegated fraud schemes. To get the genius of this particular one, we need a notion of how property tax works in Britain. So please, bear with me. It'll be over in a jiffy. In Britain, the property tax paid by ordinary citizens on their homes is called council tax. The corporate equivalent that companies pay on non-residential space is called business rates. Back in 2008, Prime Minister Gordon Brown introduced a change in business rates. The new rule said that if a commercial building, like our office building in the Edgware Road area, has no tenants, then the building's landlord must pay the business rates in full, even though that landlord earns zero revenue from renting the place. Faced with new and potentially very high taxes in the middle of the 2008 economic crisis, office landlords got inventive. Some dropped their prices to attract cheap tenants, which is what the law was supposed to do. Others didn't. They found people like overseas students and seasonal workers in the country for a limited time. The foreigners signed the lease, pretending to run businesses like candy stores and off-brand Harry Potter-themed souvenir shops. They took legal responsibility for paying the taxes. Then, when taxes were due, they flew home, leaving the taxes unpaid. The scheme works well for street-level shops, and it explains the sudden propagation of these kinds of shops in tourist areas. But if you own a whole office building, that's too much work. What you're looking for is long-term tenants whose lines of work are fully exempted from business rates. One such category of tax-exempt corporations are fish farms. Why? Bureaucracy is a many-splendored thing. Alas, precious few types of fish farms adapt seamlessly to the constraints of a London office. You could breed salmon, but you'd have nowhere to release them. You could breed lobsters, but those are finicky little creatures that require a lot of care. You could try oysters, if you could muster constant running seawater. Not easy, not recommended for your hardwood floors, but legal. Back in the late 1980s, the legal definition of a fish farm was extended to include mollusks of any description. This particular edition was meant for oysters, but it wasn't limited to them. Any description, right? That would include snails. Land snails are low maintenance, abundant, and discreet. An easy way to turn your office building into a fish farm, provided someone takes you through the steps. Enter l'escargotière. Clean, purged, and ready to cook. Coming soon, finest snail salami. Don't let the fancy French fool you. L'escargotière is a British mail-order snail farm. At heart, it consists of a giant freezer under a corrugated metal roof. Inside, 6,000 snails, frozen in suspended animation, await being deployed. Get on their website, a surprisingly decent website if I'm being honest, and purchase a kilo of snails for £14. That's around 80 snails for $19. More than enough to get you started on your foray into French gourmet cuisine, trendy cosmetics, or whatever it is you intend to do with the buggers. And it's amazing what you can do. Despite the cliche, snails are not the exclusive province of the French. They've been eaten by man as far back as 12,000 years ago. They were easy to breed, they contained enough protein, and they ran slightly slower than mammoths. During the Italian Renaissance, Pope Pius V loved snails so much that he declared them to be fish, so that he could continue eating them during Lent. Snails are devoured all around the Mediterranean basin, from Italy to Morocco. You'll find tiger snails in Nigerian markets, skewers of rice paddy snails in satay sauce in Indonesia, giant snails on the menu of New Caledonian restaurants. The only continent that never succumbed to the helicoidal delicacy is America. If you can't really be persuaded to stick them in your mouth, how about smearing them on your face? For a decade now, Korean beauty products, or K-beauty, have been on the forefront of using filtrated snail mucus in moisturization products. While, as with every trend, a good bit of skepticism is in order, the high contents of beneficial acids and collagen stimulants in snail slime do produce results, as this episode's co-writer Claire Tissot can confirm. Also, it's cheap and cruelty-free. The snails don't have to die for their slime to be harvested. They're just always producing more. Tempted to make it big in the snail verse? Stagger your snails two to a box. Chop some salad, a couple of carrots, close the lid, and wait for them to party. Land snails can lay clutches of eggs, that's the term, as frequently as once a month. And there can be anywhere from 5 to 100 eggs per clutch. Times two, because if you know one thing about snails, it's probably that they are, for the most part, hermaphrodites. Given the right conditions, a pair of snails will fertilize each other's eggs. Clutch, all right. As you will have guessed by now, the true purpose of L'Escargotière is neither food nor beauty, but rather tax evasion. A dozen boxes of snails, delicately wrapped up in white sacks and spaced out on your office floor, will munch their way through your property tax. If you're very, very quiet, you can even hear them gorge on lettuce and lust. Lescal Gautier will assist you every step of the way. For £35 or $47, they will set up what you might call a shell company. A fish farm, as per the law. They'll provide the snails at a reasonable rate, and when the tax man cometh and disputeth the tax exemption, the shell company simply folds. Having no assets, it has no money to pay the taxes before going bankrupt. Shortly thereafter, a new shell company will wriggle out of the ashes. I'd love to entertain you with the fabulous rabbit hole that is snails. The giant African snail, the Chinese mystery snail, the left-handed snails who stir their spirals anti-clockwise, the fact that they have teeth and a foot, their horns that are not horns at all, their tentacles with eyes on top, their tendency to spread exotic diseases, which is why US landing cards used to include a special category for bringing snails into the country, and how their shells provided proof of continental drift. But not today. The time has come to meet our main character, the Lord and Master of Lescal Gautier. The Snail Don. His name is Terry Ball. A northern Englishman who just turned 80 at the time of writing, Mr. Ball has been the bane of authorities for a solid half a century. And bane of authorities is more or less his job description. Cops want him, snails fear him. While he's been discreet so far, with only this picture, as far as I know, existing of him online, and that's pretty recent, he certainly doesn't shy away from detailing his shenanigans to Jim Watterson, the drenched newspaper man. Terry Ball is resolute. He will spend his remaining years messing with local councils, cheating them out of millions. He will show them fear in a box full of snails. Isn't he worried about getting sued? "I haven't got jack shit in my name," he says in a chuckle. "What are they going to do? They've stopped torturing people." For that Edgware Road office building alone, the local council is currently seeking to recover £286,000, or $385,000, from such companies as Snail Primary Products, currently renting the premises. So, you do the math and you ask, why? These monies claimed by local councils are not going into Terry Ball's pocket. They only exist on paper. Lescal Gautier charges reasonable rates for snails and nominal fees for administrative services. This man is definitely not getting rich out of snail farming, and yet, it's consuming most of his time and energy. So again, why? "I'll just do it for the devilment," he says, meaning for the hell of it. "I'll do it just to get away with it." Messing with authorities is Mr. Ball's way of getting even. Getting even with what, exactly? When Terry Ball comes into this world in 1945, Lancashire's Ribble Valley is far from being the happiest place to live in the UK, as it was voted twice in 10 years recently. The war had taken its toll, of course, but so had the end of the British Empire. Back in the Victorian era, Lancashire, a major economic centre, was famous for three things: seafaring industries, including fishing and shipbuilding, coal mining, and, most relevant to our story, cotton milling. Before India became independent in 1947, the Brits took all the subcontinent's cotton to mill in factories at home, before selling cotton fabric with a high markup back to India. This is an incredibly simplified shortcut to a story that would deserve its own episode, complete with Gandhi visiting the area, but we'll save that one for later. The long and short of it is, after India awakened to life and freedom, the milling industry of the Blackburn area collapsed, leaving the region in a sorry economic state. People had to make do, get creative, or die starving. One such creative Lancastrian was a man from Blackburn named Tommy Ball. He would fill his pram, that's a baby carriage, with secondhand clothes and shoes. On market days, he would peddle his wares at whatever stalls were open. So would his wife Mary. That worked until one day when Tommy, age 29 and father of two, was left standing in the rain at Blackburn Market, waiting for a stall that never opened. That day, walking back home empty-handed, he resolved that this would never happen to him again. Tommy Ball realized that shoes were making him much more money than clothes. He left the clothing business to his wife and focused on shoes. First, he started scanning obituaries so he could show up at dead people's houses to acquire shoes on the cheap. Then he directed his attention to shoe factories. There were a lot of those. The UK had developed a flourishing shoe industry. They put to good use their cattle for leather, their tailoring skills for custom-made shoes, and they developed an assembling technique, the Goodyear welt, that allowed you to resole the shoes when the soles wore out. Before the war, the area south of Birmingham alone employed 15,000 people in the shoemaking business. So Tommy would buy factory seconds, items with small defects that couldn't be sold at the regular price, directly from manufacturers. Then he'd punch holes in the back of shoes so they could be hung on racks. No, that's not where the 4,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire in the Beatles song came from. Those were potholes in the streets. But Blackburnians listening to Sgt. Pepper may have been thinking, how does John Lennon know about Tommy Ball? The holes in the backs of Ball's shoes became a kind of trademark. To promote his business, Ball was known to walk into pubs and buy every punter a round of drinks. The business flourished. He put his son Terry to work in the family trade when the kid turned 14. His empire grew to become one of the rare claims to fame of the Blackburn area. Every self-respecting Blackburnian owned a pair of Tommy Ball shoes. Buses would deliver visitors at his doorstep, visitors from all around the country's northern half who just came for the shoes. Ball would remain famous long after his death for having, as the BBC put it, revolutionized the footwear business. In 1981, Ball started his own flea market, an exhibition center, to support other sellers trying to make it in the trade. That's when he started ignoring the law, specifically the law prohibiting Sunday trading, which was not something to mess with and remains a hotly disputed topic to this day. Even in London at the time, you couldn't get a pint on a Sunday afternoon for love or money. The one exception, the one thing you could sell on Sundays, was religious artifacts. So, religious artifacts it was. Tommy Ball pivoted to selling Bibles, Bibles that came with free shoes. At the same time, he started the Sunday Shoe Club. Not a shop, you see, a club. You'd be charged a 5p membership fee to visit on the day of the Lord. Of course, the authorities didn't think that was cute or clever. Ball was prosecuted 3 times, upon which he turned his affections to late-night opening regulations. Playing ball with the law seems to have run in the family. And speaking of family, sometime in the 70s or 80s, a feud separated Terry, Tommy's son, from his father's empire. Terry went into the secondhand shoe business for himself. He opened competing shops in Lancashire. He traveled to Italy to pick up quality discounts. Terry Ball claims he was the only man to secure seconds from the Giorgio Armani shoe factories. As it turned out, buying designer rejects was the easy part. The harder part, before the advent of the European Union and the end of tariffs within the zone, was getting the shoes out of Italy. Corrupt officials would tax him at every border along the way, and he paid in shoes. Infuriating, but what can you do? What you can do is develop a relationship with the custom agent's bosses. No, not the Italian government, silly. The mob! Ball wised up to the fact that instead of driving a truck full of shoes across the continent, he could simply pay the Naples customs officers in agreement with the local mafiosi, park his shoes in a boat at the Naples harbor, and ship them straight to the UK. There began his relationship with the Camorra, the mafia syndicate operating in the Naples area, a relationship that seems to be holding strong to this day. More on that shortly, but first, a shag. If you thought what I think you thought, your mind is in the same gutter as that of a former Australian Minister for Gaming and Racing. Back in 2005, Grant McBride, the minister in question, made it his life's mission to ban a beer called shag.
"I'm outraged by this product," he burped in the press release.
How did we get there? And what does it all have to do with snails? Comes down to a bit of vocabulary and a pinch of natural history. If you did not think what I think you thought, Austin Powers wants a word. Shag is a Britishism for intercourse. To shag, both transitive and intransitive verb, and a shag, noun, plural shags, are common if rather familiar in the UK. The Cambridge Dictionary classifies both as offensive. It gets offended easily. However, a shag is also the name of a bird. I'm pretty sure the reason there are so many bird lovers and bird watchers in the UK is because there are birds called shags and woodcocks, great tits and blue-footed boobies. For the wordsmiths among us, they've also got the exclamatory paradise whida, the undulated tinamou, the inaccessible island rail, and the oo. Bird in point, the shag, the Phallocrocorax varius, is a kind of cormorant you'll find in New Zealand and parts of Australia. It does eat snails, but that's purely coincidental. In 2002, a British entrepreneur approached the Dutch brewery Alpha with a business proposition. No points for guessing who that may have been. Terry Ball was interested in distributing their award-winning lager if he could rename it Shag with a label to match. To tell you the truth, I'm a bit surprised Alpha went for it. The Alpha Brewery was a 130-year-old company back then, run by the same family for four generations, with strong Dutch family values, a grandma who would taste the first beer out of the factory every morning, and an environmental commitment way ahead of its time. But in the early 2000s, Alpha was looking to connect with a younger audience and international markets. The brand had made a dent into Russia and Poland. They'd launched a PR stunt with a Dutch pop group, and that British entrepreneur could open the doors to UK and Australian markets. And so he did, but launching a new beer in the UK and Australia is a bit like trying to sell coal to Newcastle, nougat in Montélimar, insert your local specialty here. You need nuclear strength PR. So, Terry Ball hired just the man for the job. Max Clifford was a publicist famous for sex-related promotions. He would later serve 8 years in prison for multiple counts of indecent assault on underage girls, so yuck, and also I don't know if I should be surprised or not. A decade before his conviction, Terry Ball sent Clifford a challenge. Get the shag beer banned from Australia. All publicity is good publicity. Hearing of the ban, beer pundits worldwide had a go at the outraged minister. And in the same breath, they mentioned the beer, which most of them had never heard of before. Alpha Breweries kept a room temperature cool, remarking that the Australian market had represented at most a million bottles in 3 years. No skin off their nose. It is entirely possible they had no idea what the word meant. Meanwhile, in the UK, the beer seems to have sold decently, according to the brewery's website, which makes zero mention of the shagadelic incident down under. Occasional beer tycoon Terry Ball tried his hand at many a business venture. He claims that at various points in his life he was a multimillionaire, with large houses and land to his name across Northwest England. He would set up multiple companies, shuffle assets between them, kill them off, and resurrect them like some corporate Lazarus to avoid paying taxes. That took him and his family to court, multiple times. He defended himself. You know what they say about people who represent themselves. He lost, badly. He was declared bankrupt and banned from being a company director for 9 years. Now, Terry Ball had a giant axe to grind. Time to get even.
I said you got £600,000 off me. I'm going to get £20 million off you, Ball told the London-centric editor.
He came across a speech by Michael Gove, Conservative Member of Parliament and at the time a shadow housing minister, meaning he held no position in the actual government, which was led at the time by the Labour Party, but was tasked by the opposition to focus on urban planning and dispute the government's position on these issues. Gove would later find fame when, alongside Nigel Farage, he spearheaded the Brexit campaign. Gove's speech on property tax to the Houses of Parliament made such a strong impression on Terry Ball, he keeps an annotated copy on his desk. Michael Gove, he says, was the only one to alert him on the consequences of the government's decision to impose business rates on empty buildings. Determined to strike back, Ball went into the tax avoidance industry in 2018. He called his company Crusader. That's how bloody-minded and determined he was. To meet the legal definition of a farm, his snails, Helix aspersa muller, the common garden snail, had to stay alive for weeks at a time. The snails disagreed. Ball found out that it was a bad idea to put more than two to a box. The gastropods engaged in wild, indiscriminate orgies. When the sex got stale and the food got scarce, they pivoted to murderous rampages. Slow ones, but murderous nonetheless. Snail cannibalism. The food itself was a major issue. Veggies would rot and attract maggots. It took 3 years of experiments and trips to pet stores for Ball to figure it out. He located a type of hamster food that didn't rot and agreed with the critters. He fattened the snails big time. Then he stored them in a freezer where they could hibernate, which they can do for years, until being released on site. Once settled in the office space, they would eat through their own body fat for weeks, without the need for a human visit. Now that he had a process in place, Ball needed customers. How do you advertise for a tax avoidance scheme? Terry Ball was not one to beat around the shrubbery. He hired a very public figure to advocate for his services. Colin Hendry was the former captain of the Scottish football team at the 1998 World Cup. No, I'm not calling it soccer. I intend to be able to return to Scotland at some point. Colin Hendry was a popular figure in the northern UK. Turns out, he was also a good choice for promoting a tax fraud business. In 2010, following a career in football club management, Colin was declared bankrupt after facing a bill of over £1 million in taxes. Mm-hmm. Terry Ball never shied away from associating with dubious characters. Take, for instance, his faithful handyman. You haven't met, but he's been in the background all the time, wielding a cleaver, chopping salad and cauliflower and carrots for the snails. Ball introduced him as Joseph. The man is quiet, but when he speaks, it's in a curious accent, a mix of Northern England and Southern Italy. His real name is Giuseppe. Back in 2008, Giuseppe Persico, then aged 34, was arrested for drug trafficking, thanks to a collaborative effort from British and Italian investigators. He served 4 years in an Italian prison. At the time, British authorities tried to prove a connection between Persico, his gang within the Neapolitan Mafia, and criminals in Lancashire. That there would be such links shouldn't come as a surprise. The Mafia has been involved in the British underworld since the 1920s. Early on, they would run horse race protection rackets. They would import gunmen from Italy and export booze to the US during Prohibition. In the 1960s, when gambling regulations loosened in Britain, they flew in American high rollers. They may well have helped British crime lord Ronnie Cray, one of the notorious Cray twins, to flee the country. The 80s were darker still. Banco Ambrosiano was an Italian bank. Its convoluted story became a massive scandal back then. In a nutshell, the bank was entrusted with money from both the Vatican and Sicilian mobsters. When the bank collapsed and money evaporated, the mobsters took it personally. The bank's director, Roberto Calvi, was found dead in London, hanging under Blackfriars Bridge. No one was ever convicted for the crime, although some historians suspect antiquarian Francesco Di Carlo. Known as Frankie the Strangler, this resident of Woking, in the county of Surrey, smuggled heroin and cannabis through his antiques firm and his travel agency. The UK has been Europe's largest market for cocaine for a while now, so there would be no reason for the Mafia to lose interest, particularly since, in the 2000s, Italy was seriously cracking down on organized crime. Some mafiosi took advantage of the pentiti, or repentance system, trading lighter sentences for information on their bosses. Others, reluctant to take up competitive rooftop diving, fled the country. One such criminal to bolt was Gennaro Panzuto. Murderer, drug trafficker, gunrunner, extortionist, and more, Panzuto was the textbook mobster. The nephew of a senior boss, he started young, stealing watches from the age of 8. He took advantage of a war between clans to head his own territory in Naples. Panzuto was so assertive and quick to act that he earned the nickname Terremoto, the earthquake. But in 2006, the police finally had conclusive proof that linked Panzuto to the murder of a rival gangster. When they closed in on the earthquake, though, he was nowhere to be found. Where was Panzuto? Terry Ball, yes, we're back at L'Escargotier now. Terry Ball answers the question. I hid him for years, he laughs. What happened was, one of Panzuto's closest associates in Naples had deep connections to an organized crime ring in northwest England. To quote Dominic Casciani, who investigated for the BBC, one of this British gang's businesses involved shipping shoes into Naples without paying any VAT. That means value-added tax. For Americans, that's roughly the same thing as sales tax. The Camorra would then sell them on and undercut legitimate traders. The British gang was headed by a businessman who appeared to be an entirely upstanding member of his community. As the police closed in on him, Panzuto's British friends offered him sanctuary in Lancashire. For legal reasons, the BBC doesn't name this upstanding community member. But while Panzuto recalls that upon his arrival at Liverpool Airport, there was a Rolls-Royce waiting for him, Terry Ball vehemently denies it. He had traded his Rolls for a Bentley by then. Ball happily outs himself. He stowed the gangster at the Six Arches Caravan Park, a family-friendly place not far from Preston, where Ball lived. Panzuto would share a pint with the locals, join them to watch football, and attempt to grow basil on his windowsill in dreary Lancashire weather. Other gang members followed suit, temporarily hidden by Terry Ball when Naples got uncomfortably hot. They would easily find jobs in the hospitality business. It probably helped that they'd work for free. It also helped that, unlike in Italy, simply being a member of the Mafia is not illegal in British law. Therefore, it's not transferred from Italian to British records upon immigration. To repay his debt to Terry Ball, Panzuto became his enforcer when dodgy businessmen wouldn't pay their dues after benefiting from his tax schemes. Panzuto did it the Neapolitan way. He headbutted one debtor, then bit off his ear. That message was heard loud and clear, although not as loud as it might have been before. The mobster moved out of the caravan park and into a house in the nearby village of Garstang, Lancashire. He took a liking to white-collar crime. Much less blood, much less police. Under Ball's direction, he moved shoes, bathroom supplies, sometimes cars, across Europe, in what the police call carousel fraud, shifting goods through front companies and dodging the VAT. In that, he was helped by his foot soldiers in Naples. Panzuto hadn't abandoned the hope of returning to his homeland and reclaiming his place on the Camorra totem pole. But over there, the clan war was still on, and war is not good for business. Panzuto asked Ball to intercede in negotiations. He refused. Panzuto then arranged a barbecue party, of sorts. A dozen mafiosi from his side of the war answered the invitation, among them bosses from three of the biggest Naples clans. They made plans to destroy their rivals while profiting from the comfortable life of crime the UK was offering. They got cocky, Panzuto got careless, and the inevitable happened. On May 16th, 2007 came the knock on the door. Arrested, Panzuto didn't fight extradition and ultimately decided to become a pentito, a snitch. He began to name names. And this is where the cleaver-wielding, lettuce-chopping Giuseppe came into the story. He was involved in some of Panzuto's shadier dealings. Before he got arrested in 2008, Giuseppe warned Ball that the earthquake had started to sing. Because it's a good idea to pay your debts, and probably because it can't hurt to have a Camorra graduate in the workforce, Ball gave Giuseppe a job when he came out of prison. Giuseppe joins Terry Ball and the journalist at the pub after a long workday. They tell Jim Watterson about Panzuto. While there's nothing excusable about Panzuto's crimes, once he paid his debt to society, he chose to do the right thing. First, as he was still in high-security confinement in an Italian prison, he gave Dominic Casciani of the BBC an extensive interview. Then, he talked on camera to Ross Kemp, an actor-turned-documentary filmmaker, and gave a tearful interview. "My life is worthless," he declared. He left the interviewer suspecting, to quote the Sun newspaper, "the former assassin now just wants his life to end because of all the guilt he feels." Well, that's not what happened. Instead, Panzuto became an anti-mafia advocate. On Instagram and TikTok, he made a name for himself, with 170,000 subscribers and over 3 million likes on TikTok alone. This earned him repeated threatening messages from his former colleagues. Yet, he trudged on. Sadly for Panzuto, his vocal stance against organized crime didn't entirely clear his slate. As we were researching this episode in mid-March 2026, he was arrested and condemned to 8.5 years in jail for drug-related crimes committed in his past. His TikTok account vanished. I, for one, am positive that Panzuto becoming a visible and respected thorn in the Camorra's side has nothing whatsoever to do with him being taken out of circulation. Nothing to do with the current Italian government going out of its way the minute it came into power to introduce reforms, weakening the anti-mafia endeavors of courageous judges and elected officials. Collusion? What collusion? Back in England, investigators were never able to charge Terry Ball with any mafia-related crimes. The only penalty he suffered is that he can't risk returning to Naples anymore. And it hurts. He remembers the time when his Camorra friends invited him to watch the Napoli Football Club play at home. As a VIP perk, they had arranged for the club's ultras to chant his name. At that, Jim Watterson must have blinked hard, because Giuseppe demonstrated, right there in the pub, "Terry Ball! Terry Ball!" All things must pass. And it certainly looks like Terry Ball's snail empire is oozing toward an end. Ball is expected in a London court to answer for his latest fish farms. In early 2026, Adam Hugg, the exasperated leader of the Westminster Council, the London area where the Edgware Road office building is located, is making noise in the media regarding the snail hoax. Up north in Leeds, a judge ruled conclusively that Ball's snail farm business was tax evasion. This setback, Ball blames on reckless landlords who failed to follow the strict guidelines he set out for them. Adding insult to injury, some of Ball's tax-adverse clients omit to pay his fees. At the time of writing, spring of 2026, problems are piling up at Lescargotier's doorstep, quite literally. The snail farm itself is under threat. The local council approved it on the basis that it would be an educational tourist attraction. Nothing on site can begin to accommodate such fiction. Worse still, on the premises, on top of Ball's offices and giant freezers, are two holiday chalets available for long-term renting. The real estate ad is a thing of beauty, inviting you to Baudissia Park, that's the name given to the premises of L'Escargotière, a coveted area with extensive plans for refined grounds. Not a word on the tenants in the freezers, not an inch of the office buildings in the AI-enhanced pictures. When Ball applied for extensive works, hoping to add another two lodges and an extra office building, the parish council fired a weapon at him literally stronger than nuclear bombs. Vague, yet ironclad, environmental regulations. The parish council requests that a thorough reconsideration of this application is undertaken, these requests being made to avoid what may well become an environmental disaster for this area of Ribchester. The official text mentions a possible incongruous encroachment into the open countryside. Of particular concern is the impact that the development could have on nearby Boyce's Brook, which flows into the River Ribble. River pollution and appropriation of public waterways have been a sore topic in British news for a few years now, and with the Ribble Valley becoming a tourist hotspot, the community has their collective knickers in a twist. It does seem like the snail game is up. Jim Watterson's article echoed throughout Britain and beyond, all the way to the US and France, to our main character's delight. What's next for Terry Ball? Apparently, he's already found a new tax property loophole tickling his fancy, one that's curiously reminiscent of his late father's Bible operation. Small-sized, unregistered charities are granted property tax exemption for their occasional yard sales. Enter the Terry Ball Pop-Up Charities. Landlords will give him the keys to an office building. Ball will invite a small number of people for a one-day event. They'll buy giant bags of mixed goods at a discounted price, and the landlords will claim tax rebates for leasing the place to a modest charity. To this end, Terry Ball is currently filling every nook and cranny of his snail farm with hundreds of thousands of pounds of cheap Chinese goods and toys. The man may have turned 80, but he's not done. He flaunts his Jaguar with vanity plates while simultaneously insisting he has no money to his name. He brags about his connections with high-ranking politicians and prominent businessmen. He shows Jim Watterson an exchange of messages with a general in the Cambodian army. Why does he have that guy's number? Yeah! Watterson remarks something along the lines of, "How about retirement?" The answer is simple. Finding loopholes and picking fights is what keeps Terry Ball alive.
"All my friends who have retired," he says, "you can't have a conversation with them. They're just waiting to die. I've had a laugh. Every day, no matter what happens, I've had a laugh."
And he certainly has.
Men in gray will get you now. You've got to hide or take the